I did work with Jack in putting together the proposal and getting the grant for this project, and we're actually near the end. There's just a couple more weeks left. And I thought, since we're near the end, we didn't really plan anything to say, like, what are we supposed to think about science and religion? What's the whole point of all this? Why did we go through it? And I've been at this for a while. I've been working on science and religion issues for over 30 years. I went to Notre Dame in 1980, and some of you probably know that Alvin Plantinga came to Notre Dame shortly thereafter to work with me. It was one of the few places at the time where you could actually work on and think about at a really high level science and religion. And I started right away working on topics that we've been talking about this whole two years. And I thought, I can grumble a little bit. I guess I've been at it for a while. And I just thought I'd just say a little bit about things I don't like in science and religion. And then I'll get on to doing something that I do like in science and religion. For example, I don't like people that take the Bible as a scientific textbook. And I think if there's anything that we've learned in the 2 years that we've been looking at this, it's that the Bible is not a science textbook. You don't go to it to get the latest scientific theory. And for me, I look at it this way. Suppose you thought it was a scientific textbook, then what you have to think is that in the first two or three chapters of Genesis, God decided to tell a bunch of Iron Age shepherds and farmers how he did it. And I'm thinking, what really must have happened is this. They said, well, God, how did you do it? You know, how did you create the world? And God said, well, E equals MC squared. And they looked at him a little puzzled, and he said, well, you see all this matter out there. It really is interchangeable into energy, and it's interchangeable, the equivalent of the matter to the speed of light squared. And they're still looking puzzled. And then he says, well, and then there's this explosion, and things went together according to the law of universal gravitation, where things come together in direct proportion to their masses and inverse proportion to their radius, or the distance apart squared. And they're still looking puzzled. And God said, well, let me put it this way. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And to me, it just seems absolutely bizarre to think that God would communicate how he did it to these first century people, or even that he thought that that would even be important to them. What's important is that God created the heavens and the earth, and that God created the heavens and the earth. There were lots of competitors back then. And the point wasn't that exactly how God did it, but that God did it, and that people were relating to the right God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and not some other or false God. And so one lesson that I've learned in doing all this is, it's a quote that Galileo does quite a bit. And we saw it in the very first lecture. The Bible tells us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And if there's anything we can learn from a two-year experience in science and religion, it's that the Bible is not a science textbook. But lots of people take it that way. And you can go to Kentucky and you can see people who take it that way. You can look at their Museum of Science and the Bible, and you'll find out that the earth is really young and that dinosaurs existed at the same time as human beings. And then what you have is, to me, what you end up with is you're going to create a whole generation of young people who are going to go to college and decide, I don't believe that stuff. And they're going to associate Christianity with really, I think, stupid things. And we're going to lose a generation. So to me, it's really important to get this one thing straight. The Bible is not a science textbook. It's not and never was, and it's not intended to teach us those sorts of things. So that's one thing I don't like. Whoops, I'm going backwards here. Another thing, I don't like a lot of atheists who work in this area. I mean, so I try to relate to them personally, but they say all sorts of really zany things. Richard Dawkins can hardly control himself when it comes to religion. One time I invited him to come and speak, to debate Al about a book he wrote, The Blind Watchmaker, and he wrote back in a really terse response. He says, I don't debate religion. And I wrote back, and I said, well, I just want you to know I didn't ask you to debate religion. I asked you to debate your book. And And to me, that was an ironic response on his part. One is, he really does talk a lot about religion, and now he can hardly control himself. He's just so upset. He's like a teenager in the locker room who had sex for the first time, and he can't stop talking about it. You know, he just can't. Religion is just, he can't stop talking about it. But and it's just overwhelmed his critical faculties. He can't talk about it in any, I think, coolly rational way. He takes whatever there is and whatever he knows there's no God, for example, so anything is evidence for that. He's lost all self-control. This is a quote from Peter Atkins, another scientist. Science is almost totally incompatible with religion. And the fact is, these are the people that academics deal with all the time. This is the dominant worldview in the academy. And I was sitting last night, or last week, listening to things Melanie was talking about and questions that other folks might have. And, you know, I think for people that don't hang around colleges and universities, that is, normal people, and maybe you'll see some of that by the end, you don't know what how much religious belief is under attack. Religious belief in general and Christianity in particular, it's unbelievably under attack in the academy. And a lot of people need to get to do a lot of things to sort of work at the various ways that it's under attack. So I don't like this, but this is what, you know, makes a living for a lot of us folks. I also get a little queasy for people who think they know how God did it. John Polkinghorne, whom I love, says, he's the second quotation, that God inserts himself in the quantum interstices, which, you know, sounds really highly poetic, and maybe God does. I don't mind people looking at how God might have done it, I guess, but people that think they've got God figured out, they know the latest scientific theory, they know how God did it. I just don't think most of us are in a very good position to know how God did it. There's a statistician who's absolutely sure that God would use chance to create the universe. And he says things like this: a chance universe is one that's free to unfold. And so, again, it sounds kind of poetic and nice, and maybe it's true. I don't mind someone saying this is how God might have done it, but these are folks who think they know how God did it. And, well, frankly, they give me the creeps. Also, a lot of people that say science proves this or that particular doctrine, or sometimes that it refutes this or that particular doctrine, and in 2 weeks, or next week and the week after, you're going to look at mind-body issues. Do we have a spirit that's independent of our brain? Do we have a mind that's independent of our brain? And I'd say the majority of Christians throughout history have thought that we were mind-body dualists, that we have a mind that's independent of our brain, or a spirit that's independent of our brain or our body. And there's a lot of really interesting science that shows how deeply dependent our minds are on our bodies. And there are a lot of Christian thinkers who think that we don't really have a mind that's independent of our bodies, or a spirit that's independent of our bodies, that we just are our bodies or our brains. The only thing any creedal statements say about this is, I believe in the resurrection of the body. That's what the creedal statements say. But most of us probably believe in the resurrection of the soul or spirit. We think our soul or spirit leaves our body. And that might be true. Maybe it's a spiritual body. To me, both of them are sort of open, even given contemporary science. They're both still open. And some people jump on a certain bandwagon, thinking science has shown this or that. And to me, what we need is a more openness to what science shows or doesn't show with respect to Christian belief. Sometimes it does refute things. I think it shows us that the earth is really old, for example. And that's occasioned a look at the age of the earth and what the original chapters of Genesis said. I think it has shown that. I'm inclined to think it shows that we are descended from some primate ancestor. I think science has shown that, and we need to come to understand that in Christian terms. So I think there are things that we have to go back and think about. But I don't think science proves this or that. And here's just one more caution. Science may change. You can wed yourself to science showing this or that doctrine, but the fact is, in 50 years, there may be another Einstein, and we may have another revolution, and there may be new things new ways to conceive of the world. Science is a really powerful way of understanding how God works in the world, but we're finite. We see from a limited perspective. I think what scientists do is absolutely brilliant. Most of it I couldn't do. And you might look at it this way. They're looking at a clock, and they see the hands going around, and they're doing a pretty good job of guessing what's back behind there moving the hands around. But people's views of what's back behind there moving the hands around have changed over the years, and it may change again. At any rate, you don't want to get too committed with your theology with respect to this or that scientific theory. So that's another thing I don't like. And the last thing, and it came up last week, but this is probably the thing I've learned most from Al, and that is that God is not a scientific hypothesis. And I think a lot of us think God is. And I think that's why a lot of science and religion issues have create such angst for us. And it creates us because a lot of people in the academy view God as a scientific hypothesis, and he's not a very good one anymore. He was a pretty good one in 1500 because people thought you needed somebody really big like God to shove planets around or to keep the planets in their orbits or every 70 years to get the planets moving. Good physics used God as a scientific hypothesis. But now we believe in inertia and the Big Bang and all these other things. And if you thought God was a hypothesis in physics, and then he does compete with the latest views in astronomy. And there are better ones than God for understanding the motions of the planets. So I've spent 30 years trying to understand Al wrote a book in the 60s called God and Other Minds, and it's going to factor in here in my talk. And the insights from that are ones that I've just been mining for over 30 years. I'm going to write a book on this, and I'm going to dedicate it to Al because it just shows this idea. It comes up in a lot of different ways, and I guarantee it comes up in ways that he could not have guessed in 1967. Not that he couldn't have guessed that I'd be here, which would have been awesome if you could have guessed that. But like the work in the psychology of atheism is directly relevant to things that he wrote about God and Other Minds in the 60s. And I don't think even 5 years ago any of us thought there was going to be work in the psychology of atheism. There had been tons of work in the psychology of religious belief, but nothing in the psychology of atheism. And I think some of the central insights in the psychology of atheism are ones that are directly relevant to claims that Al makes about God being a person. Sorry, God not being a scientific hypothesis. This is the punchline. God's a person. God relates us to us as a person. We don't hold God like a yardstick up against the universe and say, do you measure up, God? We can hold E equals MC squared up that way. No big deal. We can hold the law of universal gravitation up that way. That's what you should do. But that's not what you do with God. You relate to God. You pray to God. You thank God. You worship God. But he's not one little scientific instrument that we bring up to the universe and then say, do you size up God? And so to me, what you have to do is think about how, if God is a person, how is it that we cognize God? And that leads into my talk, which he doesn't know about. The title of which he didn't know about. And I actually don't remember the title, so I wouldn't have been offended, whatever you said. So this is the thing that I learned pretty well starting in 1980. And it's a view called Reformed Epistemology. And it comes from John Calvin. And John Calvin says, there is within the human mind and indeed by natural instinct an awareness of divinity, that we're naturally inclined, that we're sort of instinctual theists, that God has built in us. He sort of hardwired us to believe in God. That's John Calvin's view. I think he partly held it because you just look around and you see everybody in every culture believes in God. I think that's part of the reason he held it. Part of the reason he held it, I think he thought it was taught in the Bible, that God created us with the cognitive capacities to form true beliefs about God. Now, this is a view that John Calvin held on theological grounds and that Alvin Plantinga developed on philosophical grounds, which means developed for no reason whatsoever. That's what philosophers do. In fact, at the corner, at Calvin, there's a corner where down one way you can go to the theology offices and down the other way you can go to the philosophy offices. And somebody one time put signs up there, and the sign pointing to the theology section was unquestioned answers. Down to the theology section, down to the philosophy section was unquestioned answers. Sorry, unanswered questions. Anyway, so here's this thing that philosophers believe for no reason whatsoever. And we have seen in the past 20 years something that I can't remember happening in the entire history of philosophy, and that is there's actual evidence, scientific evidence for some philosophy view, that we just didn't spin it out of thin air. And Justin Barrett writes this, belief in gods generally and God particularly arises through natural, ordinary operation of human minds at natural, ordinary environments. Almost exactly what John Calvin said on theological grounds. Justin Barrett's a cognitive psychologist for a few years at Oxford, and now he's at Fuller Seminary. Melanie's working with him. He's one of the pioneers in cognitive psychology of religion. And in Melody's presentation last week, she pointed out what some of these cognitive processes are and how they incline us naturally, instinctually, normally to believe in God. So let's take a look at this a second, part of my multimedia extravaganza. Okay, how many of you think the star is bad? Did any of you start ascribing purposes to these things? You start thinking of them, you start telling a story, you start having a narrative that comes out. This is what psychologists do. They did this experiment in the 40s to see what is it that people do. You have to figure out. So here's what cognitive psychologists do. They try to figure out what's going on inside the mind. What are the kind of thought processes that, or cognitive faculties or cognitive modules that we use to think about the world? And so here's a way they get inside the mind. They find out that everybody who looks at this starts telling a story, starts to see that this is, starts to attribute agency to these inanimate objects. And they were programmed to be random. Nonetheless, we think they're not random. We think there's a story here. We attribute agency to these things. And so that's just one experiment. Melanie went over quite a few last time. I'm just going to summarize some of the work here. So that involves something like the agency detecting device, that we're all naturally inclined to attribute agency to all sorts of things. That there are things that act. And so here's a way to tell that you have it, and it's independent of this. Suppose you're sleeping at night and you hear a sound downstairs and you shoot up. You reach under your bed for your bat, and you say, "Who's down there?" That's your agency detecting device. And it got triggered just like that. It didn't take much. And then what you do once you're up, you do it instinctively. You do it automatically. You don't reflect on it. You have a slight sound, and you shoot up. You react, and there's usually a belief that's attached to it. And then you start to think, did I leave the hamburger out? Or did I, are they here to steal hamburger or my silver? Or are they here to do damage to my body or whatever? And then you start attributing purposes to the thing that's down there. And so two cognitive faculties are operative in that sort of case. One is the agency detecting device. And that's just where you think that there's something there who's acting. We do that instantly. And then we take a second, and we also instantly think about whether or not, or what the purpose is that thing might have in mind, that person or thing might have in mind. And you can see why we might have evolved an agency detecting device. Our prehistoric ancestors who didn't have one that worked pretty instantaneously likely became lion food. If you don't instantly react, it may just take that much time for you to become a victim or for an enemy to conquer you. Now, the agency detecting device doesn't just work in times of fear. You might be walking along and see an indentation in the sand, and you might form the belief that there's a person, a possible mate, for example. So it doesn't take much information for the agency detecting device to get stimulated, and you can see how evolutionarily it would be a good thing. And you could see also how evolutionarily it would be a good thing for us to ascribe purposes to those things so that we can make our plans. We can think, well, it's a lion, it wants to eat me. I'm going to get a weapon out, or I'm going to run, or whatever. Being able to figure out that purpose pretty quickly is something that's a good thing to do. So the claim is that belief in God arises from these. So the agency detecting device and the theory of mind, they seem to be the two cognitive faculties that people that work in this area all agree are involved in belief, in the production of belief in gods. So some neurologists have taken pictures and they found the God faculty. Oh, and it's there. So again, Al, you know, you seldom get your philosophical theory so well confirmed, but there it is. I have a picture of Kant's thing in itself in another talk, which you'll probably want to see. Only two philosophers got that joke. So how do people, in understanding these cognitive faculties, use them to explain religion? So you have a basic sense of the cognitive faculties. How do they explain religious belief? And you would expect, and the explanation is on evolutionary grounds, you'd expect adaptive traits, those that will help with the four Fs, fighting, feeding, fleeing, and reproducing. All of you have probably heard that joke at one time or another, but it's a joke that just keeps giving. So I couldn't resist it. So if you're going to explain how it is that human beings could acquire religious beliefs on evolutionary grounds, and then you have to do it in terms of these, it's called reproductive success, our ability to fight, feed, flee, and reproduce. But there's a problem with this. And Scott Atran, one of the pioneers in cognitive psychology of religion, raises the problem. Religious practice is costly in terms of material sacrifice, at least one's prayer time, emotional expenditure, inciting fears and hopes, and cognitive effort, maintaining both factual and counterfactual networks of belief. Religion is costly. It's evolutionarily costly. So on evolutionary grounds, it's hard to explain. Why is it costly? Well, if you're worshiping, you're not raising crops. You're not getting food. You're not finding a mate. It's not evolutionarily successful to take time out from those things to worship. If you're taking grains and sacrificing them to the gods, that's grains that could go to feed you. That's not in your evolutionary best interest. If you sacrifice humans or sacrifice virgins, there are lots of ways to put costly religious practices that look like they don't conduce to human success. Human beings, you would expect human traits and behaviors and beliefs that conduce to our ability to fight, feed, flee, and reproduce, but at first glance, religious belief or religious practices look like they're the exact opposite. They're evolutionarily costly. So the suggestion is that evolution didn't create religious beliefs. Religious beliefs were created later. They're a byproduct of cognitive faculties that were produced in order to help us fight, feed, flee, and reproduce. They're a byproduct of some other feature of human activity that is adaptive. And I've already suggested two, the agency detecting device. I've already suggested why it would be adaptive, and the theory of mind, why it would be adaptive. And the suggestion is we didn't evolve to be religious believers. We evolved to have a agency detecting device and to have a theory of mind. They're good for us evolutionarily. And as a byproduct, those produced religious beliefs. So the suggestion is that religion is, this is the scientific term, a spandrel, but non-adaptive is the easiest way to see it. And so here's a spandrel in a medieval Gothic cathedral. You have your arches, which you need. They're necessary to hold up the roof, but in between these is this decorative space. It wasn't necessary. It's not needed. It's just a byproduct. And you can put it to good use, but you didn't need it to hold up the building. So religions, Atran says, are not adaptations, and they have no evolutionary functions as such. This is the dominant view among people that work in this area. And I did a little Harry Potter thing here for adaptations, non-adaptations. So here's stairs, and all of this is necessary. Everything right here is necessary, but this part isn't. But it can be put to good use. Harry Potter fans, you can make a little Harry Potter-ish room in there. We have other things that aren't clearly adaptations. Like, I think the wrinkles on our fingers are spandrels. They're not adaptive. This was good. Being able to grasp was a good thing and selected by evolution. A byproduct was our wrinkles. We have red blood, and it gives us this skin color. I don't think there's anything special about red blood, except we survive on hemoglobin, and hemoglobin makes us look red. So the color of our blood is a byproduct. It wasn't selected by evolution. Hemoglobin was. It happens to be red. So the suggestion is that religion is like the wrinkles on our fingers. Evolution selected something else, but it ended up producing these things. So I'm going to put this a little bit. So a byproduct belief is a belief produced by our cognitive faculties that were designed to produce beliefs of a different kind. Had and Tom were designed, agency detecting device and theory of mind were designed, so to speak, to produce belief in lions and tigers and bears and enemies and friends and potential mates. That's what they were designed to produce. But they produce lots of other beliefs, beliefs of a different kind, including religious beliefs. And the claim is that belief in God is a byproduct belief. It is produced by the agency detecting device and theory of mind, which were designed to help us find mates, detect enemies and predators. And so it's a sort of accidental byproduct belief, not evolutionarily necessary. And, what do people say about this? The claim is that the God faculty is unreliable. So let's look at some quotes. God is an artifact of the brain. Our minds would just produce God beliefs, even if there were no God. That the God faculty is unreliable. That the agency detecting device produces a lot of false positives. It makes a lot of mistakes. It's better to make mistakes. You're more likely to survive, but you really can't trust the beliefs that it produces. Richard Dawkins says the irrationality of religion is a byproduct of a built-in irrationality mechanism in the brain. Daniel Dennett said the God faculty is a fiction-generating contraption. And Jesse Baring says we've got God by the throat. All we need to do is squeeze. Jesse's one of the leading cognitive psychologists who works in this area. So I've been trying to sort of make the case that unlike belief in a lion, which does look like it's necessary for our survival, belief in God isn't necessary for our survival, and it's produced by the God faculty. The God faculty was the agency detecting device and theory of mind, which are designed, so to speak, for the production of beliefs in lions and mates, for example. But not belief in God. You just let it run wild and it'll just produce belief in God by itself. And so this is the objection that many people have raised about belief in God. It looks like God is an illusion or a phantom. So I want to look at it. Is God an illusion or a phantom? Or has it been shown? By showing the cognitive faculties that are involved, Have we thereby shown that God is an illusion or a delusion? And I want to look at that question by taking a step back and looking at a different sort of question. And the question I want to ask is about a pink elephant. Okay? So suppose Karsten is invited by his brother Dathan to his birthday party, to Carson's birthday party. It's Carson's birthday. And Dathan, before the party, slips a pill to Carson. And the pill that Carson gets is a pill that produces a belief in a pink elephant, that he's seeing a pink elephant. And so Carson goes to the party. There's 30 people in the room. And all of a sudden, Carson says, "Hey, hey, everybody, there's a pink elephant in the room." And everybody laughs. Now, here's the thing that I want you to get about this. There is a pink elephant in the room. Okay, this is in my story. I can make it up however I want. There is a pink elephant in the room. But that's not why Carsten believes in it. Carsten believes there's a pink elephant in the room because he's been slipped the pill. His eyes aren't working. He doesn't see the pink elephant. It's just that the drug has produced in the perceptual part of his brain the perception of an elephant. And so he says, there's a pink elephant in the room. And so all the people are laughing because they know there's a pink elephant in the room, but they know that Carson only believes it because he's taken the pill. Now, I think Dawkins and others think that belief in God is like our having taken that pill. That we think there's a God because evolution has tricked us. It's put the God belief in our brain, and God isn't really there. But I want to look at, so do you see roughly why this is analogous? They think basically evolution has tricked us into forming a belief about God, and that we can know, just by knowing what faculties involved, that they're like this pink elephant pill. They produce beliefs that aren't true. I want to think for a second about what it would take for a belief in a pink elephant to be justified or right or rational or something like that. So what's a rational perceptual belief? And then I'm going to bring this back to belief in God. But what would it take for someone in the room to have, Carson doesn't have it, and we'll see what he's lacking, but what would it take for someone in the room to have a good rational belief about there being a pink elephant in the room? Well, it seems to me you have to have the right processes involved. So my visual faculties, for a perceptual belief, I need my visual faculties to work. My eyes, for example, my eyes have to be open. The light has to be just right. My visual faculties have to convey information to those portions of my brain that process visual information, sensations, and then transfer that information to the portion of my brain involved in believing. So there has to be some process that involves my visual faculties, my eyes, and then the visual part of my brain. So you get my rods and cones stimulated in certain ways, and they send nerve impulses along the right pathways, and then something happens in my brain, and I get the perception of an elephant. And then I form the belief, there's a pink elephant in the room. And I need the right processes to work there. I don't use memory to do that. I don't use my hearing to do that. In order to have a visual sensation, I need to see it. I need to see it with my eyeballs. And then the seeing parts of my mind that connect my eyeballs to my brain and then to the belief part, the right processes all need to be involved. And then the other thing I think that needs to happen is that the object of perception must be the cause of my belief that I see the object. And so the reason everybody else in the room has a reasonable belief that there's an elephant in the room is that the elephant causes their belief. Okay? You know, I believe Jim Bradley is right there because Jim is the cause of my perceptual sensation, and I have a rational belief that he's there, because he's the cause of it. And the reason Carsten isn't justified, they had the wrong processes. It was a drug, a pill, that bypassed eyeballs and sensory parts of the brain, and then the pill just stuck a belief up in there. There's a pink elephant in the room. That's one problem. The second problem is the belief wasn't caused by the pink elephant. It was caused by the pill. So in order for us to have a perceptual belief that's justified or rational or something, it needs to be the right processes, the perceptual faculties, and the right parts of the brain, and then the right cause. The object of perception has to be the cause of my belief. And again, in Carson's case, wrong process was the pill. And in Carson's case, he wasn't in touch with the object. And here's the thing, that's what the atheists think about belief in God. Wrong process. The process agency detecting device and theory of mind are designed to produce belief in other people, belief in predators, belief in enemies. So wrong process, and people aren't in contact with God. And so it just sort of produces it like a phantom belief, an illusion. So people are in a position like Karsten, where it's the wrong process, people aren't in touch with the object. So I want to ask, what would it take for our belief in other minds or other persons to be rational? So we've got what it would take for a perceptual belief to be rational. I think the same thing would be true of other minds. We need the right processes in order to do this. But I want us to see something about persons, and this is sometimes hard. This is easier for philosophers to see than non-philosophers. And the thing I want to see is that persons, what makes you a person are your thoughts, feelings, and desires. That's what makes you a person. And I put Data up there. He's my favorite Star Trek character. And Data is not a person. Now I know somebody out there knows that in episode 47, he found out he is a person, so forget that. Find your favorite robot that acts like they have thought, feelings, and desires, but don't. Okay, that's my point. Find your favorite robot that's not a person. That's the one I want you to think of. Because what makes someone a person is something that goes on inside. Thoughts, feelings, and desires. You can poke Data with a pin and he'll go, ouch. So he'll act like he's in pain, but he won't be in pain. You can tell him a joke and he'll laugh. So he'll act like he thinks something funny, but he doesn't think anything. You can you can tell him a sad story and he'll cry. So he'll act like he's sad, but he's not, because he doesn't have feelings. He's a robot. Now, I think all of you are persons, but here's the point. I can't tell you're persons by looking. Why is that? Because I can't see your thoughts, feelings, and desires. I don't tell it just by looking. You don't come to the belief that somebody else is a person just by looking. It's not a perceptual belief. It's not like coming to the belief that there's a pink elephant in the room. Why is that? Because I don't have access to the thing that makes you a person, your thoughts, feelings, and desires. So in order to do that, thank God we have a cognitive faculty, a theory of mind that instantly creates in us, when I look at you, but I don't have to look at you, when I look at you, I instantly believe you're a person, that you have feelings and thoughts and desires. I have a cognitive faculty that produces that belief in me immediately. So it requires a theory of mind, but here's my point. We don't perceive persons. And I'll make it more clear in just a second. Just think how many ways you can come in contact with a person. You can come in contact with a person over the radio airwaves, over television. You don't see a person on television. You see a bunch of electrons jumping around on a screen. But you can come to true beliefs about a person, their thoughts, feelings, and desires based on what you see on television. They can write you a letter. They can send you an email. They can send smoke signals. You do not need to see a person in order to come to beliefs about other persons' thoughts, feelings, and desires. There are lots of ways to come in contact with a person. But every time we judge, well, we don't judge, we just instantly form beliefs about persons' thoughts, feelings, and desires. Our theory of mind is doing it. Our perception isn't doing it. In fact, I don't even need to see people most of the time to form these beliefs. I can form them without seeing them. So there are lots of ways we can come in contact with a person. The cognitive faculty that we use is theory of mind. And sometimes I see your body and instantly believe you're a person. So sometimes perception is involved. But what's really involved is theory of mind. Theory of mind is the cognitive faculty that instantly produces in us the belief that something else has thoughts, feelings, and desires, something we can't see. Well, how about God? Now, I use God and other elephants because God and other minds was taken. What would it take for us to have a rational belief in God? What would it take? So we've done elephants, pink elephants, other persons, or perceptual beliefs, other persons. Now, how about God? What would it take for a God belief to be rational? And the point that I want to make is that if God is a person, then theory of mind is adequate to its object. It's the right cognitive faculty to use to think about God. If God has intentions and thoughts, if God is in this respect like us, God is a person, then theory of mind is exactly the right cognitive faculty to use to think true thoughts about God. So the right cognitive faculties are involved. There may be others that would be good to have if we want to know more about God, but this is a good place to start. If God is a person, then theory of mind is, it's the right, just like vision, our eyeballs are good for coming to true perceptual beliefs. The theory of mind is good for coming to true beliefs about God, assuming that God is a person. And then the question is this. So you have to have the right cognitive faculties, and then the cognitive faculties have to be caused, ultimately have to be caused by the object. So how could God cause God beliefs? I'm just going to give, to me, there are lots of ways that suggest themselves. And I think that the common way, I think there's a kind of failure of imagination on the part of Dawkins and Dennett and a lot of the new atheists. They don't imagine that anybody has ever actually had some sort of experience of God. They just think there isn't a God. Now we know, given that there isn't one, we know the cognitive faculties that produce belief in God. We know the cognitive defect that produces belief in God. But there might, if there is a God and he's created us in such a way that we have cognitive faculties that enable us to come into relationship with him, then we might expect a variety of ways for these cognitive faculties to work. So one, it seems to me, is, this is the most abstract, but it seems to me, if there is a God, that ultimate reality is not an it, it's a thou, or the universe is not an it, it's a thou, and that the universe could just kind of be pulsing person, that the universe itself declares God's glory. And it's the glory of a personal being that it itself somehow has person in it. And you see it, and he looks quizzical, and I look at him, and I instantly form the belief he's quizzical. And it may be that you can just look at the cosmos in the right circumstances and just say, there is a God. The universe you just come to that belief quickly based on, there are lots of ways it might happen. You might be on a mountaintop and be taken with the sensation that God created all this. That's the way it might happen. There might be lots of ways that if God is a person and the universe is part of God's person, I don't mean it's God's body or anything, I just mean it's declaring God's handiwork, God's glory, and it sort of pulses with person, and then the right way to respond to that is to think, there is a God that created all this. That can put you in contact with God. A person could have an experience of God, and the first one, I mean not so much direct experience of God, but I know people who've claimed to have had some sort of pretty personal and distinct experience of God. Studies have been done by sociologists in the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and a surprising number of at least Americans think that they've had a direct experience of God. Not the sort of first kind where it's more, I guess, slightly more abstract, but where God has spoken to them in a certain way and spoken to them in a clear and personal way. If that's the case, it seems to me that theory of mind is the way to acquire true beliefs about God. Or God could send a message to us through a book. And for those of you who are a little slow, maybe the Bible would be that book. Or it could happen in a sermon. If human beings can send smoke signals and we can acquire true beliefs about the intentions of the person sending the smoke signals, then God could certainly write us a book and we could acquire true beliefs about God through that book. And you also, maybe you didn't you yourself haven't had a personal experience or of God, but somebody that you trust did, and they told you about it. And if they were in contact with God, then it's perfectly reasonable for you to have a true belief about God based on that testimony. I'll just give you a story. In the early 90s, I was traveling to, I was in France, and we were traveling back, and when we went to get on the plane, Joe Montana was on the plane, and his wife, who was an underwear model, or so I've heard, and they had small kids, so they came up, and my daughter Emily was less than a year old, and she came up and said, "Can I hold your daughter?" So she held Emily, and then Joe Montana had to come up and try to be friendly. His wife was very friendly, so we were waiting in line for probably 15 minutes, talking away, and then we get on the plane, and we get off in Chicago. We had come back from France. They'd been spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on fancy French antique furniture, and we were spending nickels and dimes on whatever we were doing. But what, you know, pauper and prince alike, we all had to wait for our luggage to come off, and we waited about 35 or 45 minutes. So she came over and held our baby again, and Joe Montana came over, and I got an autograph from Joe Montana. And now, here's something you should know. Joe Montana was got his degree at University of Notre Dame, same place I got my degree. Joe Montana misspelled my son Will's name. Okay, so take that into account for everything you hear from now on. So here's my point. I just told you stuff about Joe Montana. Everything I told you is true. So you've learned something about Joe Montana based on testimony. And as long as it's true, as long as I did have that encounter with Joe Montana and I haven't embellished or lied, I can get out the autograph. I have it at home, and you can see W-I-L. Again, we have a degree from the same place. You can learn true things about other people based on what other people tell you. So if someone had an experience of God, or if someone believed in God, truly believed in God on the basis of something coming into contact to God through a sermon or through an experience on a mountain, if there's a testimony chain that leads back to somebody that connected to God in the right way, then you can have a justified belief in God based on that. And in every case, what's operative is the agency detecting device and the theory of mind. You're coming to a belief about God as a person. So my point is this. You can't tell from identifying the cognitive faculties that are involved in the belief whether or not somebody has actually gotten causal contact with God. You can't tell. But just by identifying that people use the theory of mind and the agency detecting device to acquire beliefs about God, you don't know anything about the cause of the belief. You don't know anything whatsoever. So Richard Dawkins, who declares God is a delusion, that now that we know that theory of mind and agency detecting device were operative, or that it was a belief that wasn't selected for, you can't tell anything like that based on the fact that we have cognitive faculties. All you know is that when someone comes to a belief in God, it probably used the agency detecting device and theory of mind. And if they came to belief in God through any of these ways, then their belief in God can be perfectly well justified. But what's operative in every case is the agency detecting device and theory of mind. But knowing that the agency detecting device and theory of mind were at work doesn't tell you anything about whether or not the belief was rational. What makes it rational is whether or not somebody got into causal contact with God, if God was the ultimate cause of that belief. If there is a God and he wants us to come to know him, it wouldn't surprise me that he created us with cognitive faculties so that we could, and that he created situations where we could come into contact with God. All I've said so far really is that if there's a God and he wants us to come to know him, then it wouldn't surprise me if he created us with cognitive faculties that we could come to know him, and that he would help let us get into situations where we could form true beliefs about him. But knowing that agency detecting device and theory of mind are operative, you don't know if somebody if somebody's belief is a phantom or an illusion. You just can't tell that. Now, the interesting thing is there's been work, and it's only been published in the last year or so, work on the cognitive psychology of atheism. And the interesting thing that they found out in cognitive science of atheism is that there's a connection between atheism and autism. That whereas it's perfectly normal and natural to form religious beliefs, because the theory of mind and the agency detecting device are perfectly normal and natural, there's a cognitive defect that's correlated with and sometimes caused by autism in the production of atheistic beliefs. And it's not, the correlation isn't just tiny, it's huge. So there's an autism spectrum, and they do tests and see where people are in the autism spectrum. And the higher people are in the autism spectrum, the less likely they are to believe in a personal God. And it's not so, if you're way high in the autism spectrum, you're 11 times more likely to be an atheist or an agnostic than if you're what psychologists call a neurotypical, somebody who's normal. 11 times. Now, why is that? It looks like the reason is that autistic individuals lack the theory of mind. They don't have the cognitive faculties that gives them direct access to people's thoughts, feelings, and desires. So they can't respond to people as people. And Simon Baron Cohen, and that's not Sasha, it's Sasha's brother. There's probably a generational divide here. Some of you, chuckled knowingly, but it's not a joke. Simon Baron Cohen is one of the leading experts in autism studies in the world. And he says this is the term he uses. He says, autistic individuals lack the ability to mind read. They can't read other people's minds. And I use with theory of mind. There are other terms that people use, but they lack the ability to directly access people's thoughts, feelings, and desires. If God is a person, then even if God were to come to someone who's a high-functioning autistic, they lack the ability to cognize God. They can't have normal personal relations. They lack that ability. So if I were an ordinary Dawkins type, what I would say is that atheists are defective, cognitively defective. That's what I would say. But actually, it's not true. We don't know about any particular atheist, why they're an atheist. We don't know where they fall on the autism scale. So you're 11 times more likely, if you fall high on the autism scale, to be an atheist or an agnostic, but there are people high on the autism scale that are theists. So we don't know, based on where you fall on the autism scale, if you're an atheist or an agnostic, and we don't know if you're an atheist or an agnostic where you fall on the autism scale. We have no idea. Now, if I were Dawkins, I would just sort of note this correlation and say mean things about atheists, but you can't. You just don't know about any particular person, even though there's a general tendency that associates autism and unbelief. And it's one you would expect. If theory of mind is essential to belief in God, then people that lack it are probably not going to have belief in God. Here's an interesting thing about it. So I said there's a autism spectrum. You can also put people on autism spectrums as classes of people. So women fall very low on the autism spectrum. They have very good theories of mind. They're really good at identifying thoughts, feelings, and desires. And then men are above women on the autism spectrum, which is not a good place to be. And then above men are college professors. Above them are scientists. Above them are mathematicians. And then than people with Asperger's. Frankly, I think a lot of universities have a lot of people that are sort of high-functioning autistics that lack the ability to cognize God even if there is one, and then high-functioning autism. Now, this stuff about men and women, my wife, when I said, oh, Sue, you got to hear this. Women are a lot better at are a lot more attuned to people's feelings than men. And she's gone like, I've been telling you that for 30 years. Well, science has proved it. She wasn't too impressed. And then I said, and the other thing is there's a lot of college professors that seem to have, you know, like Asperger's, you know, and high-functioning autism. And she's going, I know. Anyway, that the scale of belief follows that spectrum that I just had. And so you're more likely, if you're a woman, to be a religious believer than you are if you're a man, and you're more likely to be a religious believer if you're a man who's not a college professor and on up the lines. And so it attaches to what people have intuitively seen about religious belief. People have known for a long time that women are more inclined to religious belief and more actively participatory in religious practices. So it shows things that people have known intuitively. Now, since atheists, I'll just bring us to our last slide. Remember Jesse Baring, what he said, as soon as we figured out that agency detecting device and theory of mind are the things that cause belief in God, don't need any contact with God. He says, we've got God by the throat, all we need to do is squeeze. Well, we might be squeezing the necks of some atheists right now, but I don't think that's what follows. When atheists themselves find out that there's a psychological defect that's correlated with their own belief, they don't say we've got atheists by the throat. They say really sensible things like this. And so this is from one of the psychologists that I think has done the best study on atheism and autism. He says, we emphasize that our data do not suggest that disbelief solely arises through mentalizing deficits, the lack of theory of mind or inability to mind read. Multiple psychological and sociocultural pathways likely lead to a complex and overdetermined phenomenon such as disbelief in God. This seems to me to be the sensible conclusion to draw. We don't know in any particular case what it is that caused anybody to be an atheist, even though there's an interesting correlation between atheism and autism. So in general, there's this correlation. In particular, we don't know anything about anybody, and we shouldn't be speculating about anybody's abnormality or mental deficit or autism or Asperger's if they don't believe in God. We just shouldn't do it. We don't have access to that, to the insides of their minds. But we shouldn't do it with respect to religious belief either. And this is what they should have drawn when they learned that the agency detecting device and theory of mind are involved in religious belief. And I've just changed things here, equals for equals. We emphasize that our data do not suggest that belief in God arises solely through agency detecting device and Tom. Multiple psychological and sociocultural pathways likely lead to a complex and overdetermined phenomenon, such as belief in God. That, to me, seems to be the sensible conclusion we should draw from all this. A person could be perfectly reasonable in belief in God, and probably an atheist could be, too. But knowing that there are psychological tendencies that are involved doesn't tell us anything about whether a belief or unbelief is normal, natural, rational, irrational. We have no idea. And we should just humbly say we respectfully disagree. Thank you.